Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Seror, the son of Bechorah, the son of Aphiah, and the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man, and there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up he was taller than any of the people. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to his son Saul, "Take now with you one of the servants and arise, go search for the donkeys." He passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. Then they passed through the land of Shalim, but they were not there. Then he passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they could not find them. When they came to the land of Suf, Saul said to his servants who was with him, "Come and let us return, or else my father will cease to be concerned about the donkeys and will become anxious for us." He said to him, "Behold, now there is a man of God in this city, and the man is held in honor. All that he says surely comes true. Now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us about our journey on which we have set out." Then Saul said to his servants, "But behold, if we go, where shall we bring the man? For the bread is gone from our sack, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered Saul again and said, "Behold, I have in my hand a fourth of a shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God, and he will tell us our way." Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he used to say, "Come and let us go to the seer." For he who is called a prophet now was formerly called a seer. Then Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. And as they went up to the slope of the city, they found young women going out to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" They answered to them and said, "He is. See, he is ahead of you. Hurry now, for he has come into the city today, for the people have a sacrifice on the high place today. And as soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now therefore, go up, for you will find him at once." So they went up to the city. As they came into the city, behold, Samuel was coming out toward them to go up to the high place. Now a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, "About this time tomorrow I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel, and he will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regarded my people, because their cry has come to me." When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "Behold, the man whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people." Then Saul approached Samuel in the gate and said, "Please tell me where the seer's house is." Samuel answered Saul and said, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, and in the morning I will let you go and will tell you all that is on your mind. As for your donkey, which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? It is not for you and for all your father's household." Saul replied, "I am not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my people, the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Why then do you speak to me in this way?" Then Samuel took Saul and his servants and brought them into the hall and gave them a place at the head of those who were invited, who were about 30 men. And Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the portion that I give you, concerning which I say to you, set it aside." Then the cook took up the leg with what was on it and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, "Here's what has been reserved. Set it before you and eat. because it has been kept for you until the appointed time, since I said I've invited the people. So Paul ate with Samuel that day. And when they had came down from the high place into the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the roof. And they arose early, and at daybreak Samuel called to Saul on the roof, saying, "Get up, that I may send you away." So Saul arose, and both he and Samuel went out into the street. And as they were going down to the edge of the city, Samuel said to Saul, "Say to the servant that he may go ahead of us and pass on, but you remain standing now, that I may proclaim the word of God to you."
Thank you, Hector, for reading 1 Samuel chapter 9. Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to point out, you have a beautiful translation. Just beautifully done. Perfect in every single word. I want to point out, because so many translations are so poorly done. If you don't mind, what book is that?
This is the American Standard Bible.
Just well done on that chapter. So many of them do a very horrible job and screw up words, and that hit it every single time. Which we'll get to that when we get there. First of all, are there any questions regarding this chapter? Yes, Ellie.
There's something beautiful I saw in it. Does that count?
What did you see beautiful?
Okay. Saul is Benjamin.
Yes.
Shiloh, Rachel's kid.
Right.
And the second king is David, Judah's kid.
Right.
And the temple was in Shiloh, and when Rachel's kids blew it, the 10 tribes.
Yep.
Ephraim.
It
then
moves.
God brought in Judah, and then it worked.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And God had planned this.
Yes.
He planned it very, very well. I mentioned last week, does God really know why he chose Saul? I mean, obviously he regrets it. He chose him for a reason, which is in this chapter as well as the following one. And I think it ends in chapter 11 as far as the reasons why God chose Saul versus anybody else. And he was the perfect choice for this first king because Saul didn't give him kingship. God didn't give him kingship. Samuel does not anoint Saul as king. Not in this chapter or the following chapter or any point in time is Saul ever anointed king. He's anointed ruler or prince,
commander,
somebody who has control of. David is the only one that God used the word king. There's a difference. Why would God do that? Because of this. This is symbolic of the first coming of the Messiah. He's not anointed king when he first gets here. Although his apportioned is given to him at the appointed time, just like what Samuel's telling Saul, this is for your appointed time. You're here, it is yours, eat. And we find the next chapter, half the people reject him as king. But the other half don't. It is the first coming of the Messiah. God chose Saul for a reason, to point out, I'm going to have two people as my ruler. The first one doesn't actually get to be king. In this case, the Messiah the first time is not king. God appoints his king after, which is David, or in this case, after, which is Messiah, when he comes back the second time. It's a well-done thing. Yes,
yeah,
Susan.
Kind of to add to that, I noticed that in this translation, the portion that Samuel gives him is the thigh and the fat tail, which is the priest.
Exactly.
Which would also parallel with Yeshua coming as the priest.
Precisely, which is exactly what Samuel did and why he did it. The guy was brilliant. Brilliant. He knew what he was doing. Okay, so sorry, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent there. It's a simple chapter. Deceptively simple. Because Samuel's whole life, he spends writing down symbols as he goes through it. And he writes the recording down. There's a reason why God chose donkeys to be missing. And it took 3 days for this to happen. Yeah, there are reasons why God chose these events to catch your attention, why Samuel recorded them, because they meant something. And why this happened to be on a holy day when Samuel was going up and this whole big feast was happening. This is a big deal. It's not just some arbitrary events. These are built, the God built up to say, hey, here's a picture. You don't get it yet, but here's a picture anyway. And write it down. And Sammy wrote it down. Yes, David.
I would see it as God causing the donkeys to stray.
Exactly.
To create this whole thing. It's just a part of the detail.
Precisely. It's just a chain of events. Seemingly random, but they're not. Yes,
and
Ellie.
Saul is ahead above all of the rest of the people.
Easily distinguished.
Saul was above
all the rest of the people.
He was unique.
He was unique. Okay, so.
But Saul didn't find the donkeys.
No, he didn't. He didn't find the donkeys. He wasn't supposed to find the donkeys, and we'll get into why he wasn't supposed to find them.
He didn't seem like he wanted to stay with the job of finding the donkeys either.
To some extent. We'll get into that shortly, because there's a reason. Saul has his reasons as to why he's going through his train of thought, which we'll get to as well. It's actually quite simple. But we'll get there in a minute. Okay, any other questions or comments? I'm sure there's more.
I know. You can see.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. We're going to get through a few of them.
Who have to steal their bride in the vineyard at Sukkot.
And Saul is a descendant of Ehud. It is very well. God knew what he was doing. And Samuel just recorded it faithfully and happily. And I'm sure Samuel figured it out too. Because he spoke to God too readily and too frequently on a conversational basis almost. For God not to talk to Samuel. So I think Samuel figured it out also. Okay, anyways. Let's go through this, because there's some points we got to hit. First of all, the earlier part of the reason why I liked Hector's translation is most of your translations probably say, not say all of them do, but probably say, in verse 2, it says that he had a son, this is from Achish's son, Saul, who was exceptional, and many of you will say young, or young man. Yeah, that's not there. The word young is not. He's not a young man. The word is good man. Honorable, distinguished. He could be 100 years old. He could be 5. It's good, not young. There's a big difference between the two of them. And as I mentioned last week, I know it was a little bit hard to swallow. How old is Saul about this time? He has got to be at least 40. Why? Because the same year he's anointed, Jonathan, his son, takes over a battalion of Israel. Jonathan has to be 20 years old to do that or older. And if Saul is not at least older than his son, something's a little wrong. So we know Saul has some age to him. He's not an old man. But he's not as young as we think of, like, you know, some 20-ish or teenager. He's been around a little while, all right? So he's not young. Does he know Samuel? Surprisingly enough, he does not. It doesn't seem like he knows Samuel.
Right.
How can he not know Samuel? Well, think about that.
In the world.
What is Samuel's job? He's a judge. But what does he do on a daily basis?
Where
does he live? He lives in Ramah, which isn't that far from where Saul lives. But Samuel's a judge who goes throughout the country and solves your problems. If you don't have problems, do you go see Samuel?
No.
How many of us know the Superior Court judges in Stone County?
No.
Oh, yeah. Some might. Most of us don't. Why? Because we don't interact. I couldn't recognize the guy or girl, whoever it is, if I ran into them. I would have no idea who they are. Yes.
I didn't need them. They needed me.
Okay. Let's move on past that. The point is that normally the average person, good or bad, isn't going to know all the judges' names. Isn't going to necessarily recognize them by face-to-face unless they've met them before. Saul had no cause to meet Samuel. Which we'll learn in the next chapter, Saul's uncle knew him. Saul's uncle knew who Samuel was, because Saul's uncle wanted to know, what did he tell you? But we'll get there when we get there. Okay, so let's move forward. Actually, hold on. Let's move back just a hair. Sorry about that. I jumped to verse 2. I hit verse 1 first. Saul, his name. What does it mean?
Requested
one. Now, does he get that name at birth?
No.
Ah, maybe. We'll get there in a minute. The requested one equally applies to him being chosen as king, right?
Yeah, requested by Israel.
Requested by Israel. But Kish, how many children did Kish have? Well, Jewish tradition says he had one.
Saul.
And he had him as a relatively old older man. Not an old man, but relatively older. Kish wanted a son. So it can apply to either application, whether or not he was requested by Israel, thus they gave, God gave him Saul, or Kish requested him as, God, please give me a child. And Saul was the product of that. We don't know which one it is. Either way, it means requested one. Who is the mighty man of valor, though?
His father.
His father, Kish, not Saul. The Kish was the strong one. Kish was the father's household. He was the one who had strength and had power, had knowledge, and most likely battle experience. Because he would have gone through some battles with Israel, defeating and fighting the Philistines, but Saul may not have been. Yes, Tammy.
Yeah, the fact that, that Saul did not know Samuel personally, if he's not the representative of his household, he would not be going to Samuel or anyone of his level for judicial issues anyway, because he's not the representative of the family.
Exactly.
That kind of case.
Which we're going to get, not now, but in a few chapters from now, we're going to get where Saul normally goes. Because when there's a meeting amongst the tribes and the households of various families, and they all go to Samuel, well, who goes? Well, obviously the heads. Do they go all by themselves?
No.
Not usually. They usually have either an assistant, their children, their sons who will be taking over their jobs. Well, what happens? Well, we haven't read that yet, but we'll read it. What happens when this whole thing comes together and Samuel finally tells everybody who the king is? Where is Saul? They look around. He's not around. Where is he? He's with the luggage. He's with the baggage.
Right.
Why? Because that's his job. He's way back there. Yeah, he may be 40 plus. That's his job.
Same thing happened to David later on.
Exactly. It's no different. These guys are. There is a status of position. Father means head of household. You own. You control the whole house, including all your sons and nieces and nephews, depending on how old your brothers may or may not be. That's pretty fundamental. It doesn't change. When Kish died, who would then take over Kish's purpose? Saul would do it. He would take it over. Hence, he still would be brought to the meetings, but he didn't necessarily have to be partaker of the meetings. He doesn't know what was going on. So, we'll get there when we get there. It'll be a few chapters from now. But Kish is the mighty man of valor. He is the battle warrior. He's the one who's fought wars. Has Saul fought wars?
Nope.
Not likely. He might have, but not likely. Not at this point in his life. Okay. Why was his appearance recorded? Why do you think Samuel recorded the appearance of Saul? He's a tall man, he's very good looking, very handsome individual, a goodly man, not young. He was a godly one. Why would Samuel record this?
To substantiate how people look on the outward appearance.
Yes, it does substantiate that. It points it out. Because Samuel chose any old schmuck, just a nobody, just some random person, what does that mean for the person who has to follow them? I look at Samuel and say, oh, you've chosen the guy over there. I look at him and say, okay, whatever. Versus, okay, Samuel chose the guy over, and I look up. Oh, over there. Okay, I can get behind that. He looks like a king. He looks like one to a human being or a man who is looking. Samuel records it because of what happens with Jesse and Jesse's first son that Samuel thinks, oh, he looks like a king. And God says, no, we did the whole outward appearance with Saul. Now we're not going with the outward appearance method. We're going to choose David, obviously go through all the sons, and Samuel learns that. Oh, I need to not look through what I have been accustomed to looking at. I look through what God points out. So it's a distinction between what we think what a king looks like versus what God says a king actually looks like. Doesn't care what the outward appearance is. It's their actions and who they are inside. So we'll get there when we get there. I don't mean to jump ahead too often, but it's really important to this chunk of Saul's and Samuel's interaction. Okay. Donkeys go missing. What is a donkey?
A beast of burden.
A beast of burden. And what does it mean to God? What's the symbol? What's the symbol of a donkey to God? Do you recall?
It's the firstborn.
It's a firstborn. Firstborn child. Firstborn male in particular. So the firstborn By the way, this is recorded in the Torah. It's recorded that when the firstborn male is born, you will break the donkey's neck for the redemption process. That is they translate. God translates one of the same. And the Messiah comes in on a donkey's colt. It's because the firstborn carries him in. I.e. the Messiah found the firstborn, but we'll get there later. Saul didn't. So donkeys go missing. Saul has to go find them. Has to go get the firstborn of God back, or his donkeys of his father back. See the symbolism? If Kish was God, and Saul was the Messiah, and Saul has to, go find the firstborn of his father, it's the same symbol. As Kish being Kish instead of just God, and Saul being his son, has to go find the firstborn of his father who went missing.
So the donkey can be killed.
Well,
to redeem,
to bring him back. Well, anyway, so these are just compound symbols on top of each other. So God doesn't waste stuff. So goes finding donkeys. It takes him 3 days going out. And does he find the donkeys?
No.
What was so unique about this? Well, look at where he went. Not that you're going to rememberize all this, but you didn't have to. Saul's family lives somewhere in the, northeastern chunk of Benjamin's territory. Somewhere up around that area. That's the little I'm sorry, my little dots are all over the place because they're showing arbitrary boundary lines. Benjamin's territory is distinguished, this little black mark or chunk over here, the swath of territory, is Benjamite, or Benjamite land. Judah is south, Dan's to the west, and Ephraim's up north. So Saul's family lives in this general area. It's close to Gilgal, where they crossed over. Remember, Joshua crosses over right around here. It's close to Jericho, which is also right near that crossing point. So he lives not too far from there, within a few miles or so, give or take some. He travels from where his territory is, and it points out it goes to the mountains of Ephraim. Actually, it's more the hills of Ephraim, not actually the mountain of. He crosses it over and heads to Shalishia. I'm going to pronounce it correctly. Shalishia. Shalishah. Which means, that's actually a person's name, by the way, not a place. It is the territory owned by the man named Shalishah. It's a play. It's just his territory, which he owns it. Actually, he did own it. He's long since dead by the time Saul shows up, but his family line still runs the territory. So he goes, which is actually toward the northwest of where Saul lives. Does he find the donkeys there? No. So he goes, okay, we can't find him here. Let's go to Shalalim, which is the east side of where Saul lives. So he went north, west, east, and then Ramah, or Zuf, the land of Zuf, is south. Zuf is a territory. The Ramah is a city that resides inside of the Zuf territory, or a land. So it's just a man thing who happened to own the territory. Nothing really impressive there. So he travels all four directions before he finally ends up in the south. Which, again, there's a Messiah in the little going there. You have all the four directions of the earth, and he finally ends up where Judah lives. But, so we'll get there. Actually, I don't know if we'll get there or not. That's more of Jeff's territory. So he goes south. It says Elisha Zuf, which his servant points out, man of God lives here. Okay. Yeah. What city in Zuf are they at? If the man of God lives in this town. Well, the man of God, referring to Samuel, lives in Ramah. So, what city are they in? They're in Ramah. Now, it also points out they went through all the territory of Benjamite, or Benjamin territory. The word's actually Yamin territory, not actually Benjamin territory. They didn't necessarily have to travel all the territory of Benjamin to be the area of Yamin. Because Yamin was also the man, also territory of the land that was also owned, just like Zuf and Shalimim and Shalisha. They're just territories that are owned. But it happens to be located right in the dead center of most of the Benjamite territory. That's who the man happened to, where he happened to have lived. So he did cover the dead center also. I didn't want to leave that part out. Oh, so he goes there. He says, all right, let's go home. 3 days have passed. We need to return. Or follow, worry about us. You must come back. Return to my father. Father, what about us versus these lost donkeys, these lost children of Israel, so to speak, being lost? He and his servant says, wait, stop, there's a man here, let's go see him. Now Saul goes and sees the man. Of course, they go through a process of, all right, does he live here? The maidens come out. Oh, yes, we have this wonderful feast that's happening. He's here to reside over it. He has his guests, which we'll get there at the end of the chapter again. Follow this route. They could have simply said yes. They actually gave a very verbose response to him. Whole paragraph worth of commentary that said yes. Essentially, they just said yes, but it took a long time to say it. You know, God's good on timing. Right. If Samuel is walking about 3 minutes late, what does that do? You just delayed Saul to make sure it hits right Samuel when God said he will meet you at this point in time tomorrow. Because as we read that, it points out that it says God spoke to Samuel the day before about this time. A man will come to you. I will point him, or we will point him as ruler. It better be hitting the right time. Delay him a few seconds if need be. We're going to get there. And that's what he did. Delayed him just a few seconds, long enough to get this whole verbose statement out. Of simply just them saying, yes, go that way. It was, no, we're doing all this wonderful production that's happening. But what other purpose did it serve? Was it just to delay Saul? No. God doesn't do things just happenstance because he felt like it. There are purposes to things. So what did it gain Saul? What did Saul gain by all this verbose conversation with these ladies? Well, we learn from Samuel when he points out to the cook at the appointed time, which means that's through the Moedim, which is the phrase, but it's the appointed time that it will occur. Saul needs to know this is an appointed time. This is a big occasion. Not just some arbitrary, yes, he's over there. Saul had to learn something. This was planned. This was done in advance, which he learns as the chapters go through. He learns, okay, Samuel, I get it. But he didn't know it yet. Saul learned this is an important holiday, whatever you want to call it. We're not quite sure which one it is. It's a high day. We don't know which one it is, though. It could be a new moon celebration, not likely, but it could be. It could have been a holy day celebration, which is most likely, but we don't know for sure which one it happens to be. All we know is it's warm enough outside to be on a roof. So, but that's all we know about it. So it's not dead of winter. It's probably not, you know, sometime in the Hanukkah at all. It's more likely sometime in the spring, summer, or fall, which, of course, all the high days are at. So it does point to Saul. This is an appointed event. Well, what does God, as I mentioned this earlier, what does God tell Samuel in verse 17? When Samuel sees Saul, Samuel saw Saul, and the Lord speaks to him and says, this is the man of whom I said, this one will rule over my people. Now, I mentioned this earlier. He does not say, this one will be king over my people. He does not use the word melech here. It is a ruler. Just somebody who is control or take care of. He'll not be king. God does not allow Saul to be appointed king. The people of Israel make him king. That's their business. But God does not make him king. God makes him a ruler. Yes, Susan.
Everett Fox notes that the word really would be more close to restrain.
Yes.
He will restrain my people.
It is a controller, one that says, all right, you will do this no more, no less. That's his job. And that's what he does. But the people of Israel, the following chapter, or the chapter after that, say, oh, we have a king.
Yeah.
God never used that phrase referring to Saul. He does not call Saul a king. Because he's not a king in God's eyes. He's a someone who restrains or a ruler. David is the king that God chose.
In the sense of restraining, I mean, they were clamoring for the king, that God really was going to be their king.
Quiet them down.
It's almost like God saying, okay, I'm going to restrain you until the right time.
Exactly. It wasn't ready yet. David was too young. He was too inexperienced to be king at this point in time. He's a relatively young man. He needs to learn a whole lot before he can become king. Beyond that, it would ruin the entire symbolism that God's setting up if he chose David right off the bat. It wouldn't have worked. So he needed Saul to prove out, all right, we're going to do something twice, guys. We're going to do Saul ahead of time. Messiah's going to come the first time. He won't be a king. He'll be a ruler, but he won't be a king. He'll be distinguished, but he won't be a king. He'll restrain you. He'll guide you. He'll teach you. He'll control, so to speak, your actions. But he won't be a king yet. The second time he comes around, that's when he's king. The second choice, that's the king. Yes,
verse,
Ellie.
My verse 16 said, "And you will anoint him commander over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have looked upon my people because of their cry unto me."
Yes.
Okay, does he not rescue us from our...
The Messiah, yes.
Right. Yeah. Messiah rescued us from our tormentors. And here, Saul's job was not to be king.
It was to rescue the people.
From the
no different than a judge's job. It was no different than all the judges had to do the same thing. Rescue my people from the opposing forces. The same thing. God did not change their tasks from leader to leader, from generation to generation. Never changed. Messiah didn't change anything either, so to speak. And that he still had the same task allotted to him, just like all the prophets had allotted to them. You will rescue my people from their enemies. In this case, we have a physical enemy called Philistines, but in Messiah's time, it was more of sin, which is a little different. There's a lot of symbolism going on here, throughout here. Yes, it is. Sorry, go say it out loud.
Oh,
the word commander.
The commander is Nazi, which
yes.
is prince.
Yes. I'd gotten that. It wasn't there yet, but yes, that is the proper word. Let's see here. Did I miss anything important yet? No. Okay. Now, we had just read, that was verse 16, record that Ellie read. 16 and 17 or just 16? Let's see, 16. That it will save my people, for I have seen the distress or heard the distress of my people since his cry has come before me. Now, we had learned in the previous chapter, two chapters ago, that the whole time that, this according to what is recorded, that Samuel was judge, the Philistines were subdued. So why is it now God saying, I've heard the distress? Well, doesn't that seem contradictory? Mm-hmm. If we learn that as Samuel being judged, the Philistines are subdued, but Samuel's still judge right now. He didn't anoint Saul just yet. When we're getting there in the next chapter. He's still judge, but yes, the Philistines aren't subdued anymore? What's going on? Well, you gotta remember, what is the job of the Philistines? Not the job of the Canaanites, the job of the Philistines. Well, Canaanites and Philistines had both the thorn side thing. They both had that task. It's a harassment. What is it to be under them or influenced by them versus not to be under them or influenced by them? Judgment. The mere existence thereof. Keep in mind, people of Dan, the people of Judah, actually Dan in particular, had to flee. They left. Parts of them took off when the Philistines showed up. Why? Because after like 40 years, 50 years, the Israelites didn't go over and take over the territory. And God said, you guys take it too long. So you brought the Philistines along to do it. Which Philistine word means invader. That's all it word means. Brought the invaders in to take care of the rest of the Canaanites that the Israelites wouldn't do. But that doesn't mean God wants the Philistines there forever. That was not the agreement. The agreement wasn't to Abraham, oh, you have all this territory except this one little spot that I want to stay remaining exactly as is. It resulted in being that, and they still remained a thorn in the side of Israel, because look where they're placed. You look at the map of Israel, where are the Philistines? Also, we call the Gaza Strip. Where is that? It's right about, we call our midside. In the side, I choose the side, but yes, you could say the rear. It's not a very convenient place. And they are still the same. Nothing has changed. They still remain a thorn. So yeah, God hears this. That hears the cries. That hey, God, all this territory we don't have, it belongs to us. We still fight skirmishes back and forth with the Philistines. Yes, we subdued them. It doesn't mean we got rid of them. They're still around. They still fight us. They still have warriors. They still have battles. They just don't win them. That's the only difference. Still, God has to deliver them. No different from any other judge. He has to deliver them. So yes, though it does appear to be a contradictory statement, it really isn't. The point is that the Philistines are still there. So God has to raise the king up to get rid of them. Because Samuel couldn't get rid of them. He didn't say that all of Samuel, the Philistines disappeared. It says they were subdued. I mean, they didn't win battles anymore. And they didn't win battles after Samuel took over. They won the Eli battle, that was about it. That was prior to his reign as judge. So God points out in verse 17, there'll be ruler, not king, over my people. Saul's anointed, and Samuel anoints him next chapter, which we're not there yet. Does Saul know about the kingship?
No.
It would appear that. He doesn't know about the kingship. Or sort of. You see, all of Israel got together and talked to Samuel the previous chapter and said, hey, we want a king. We're tired of this whole, you know, hodgepodge, rinky-dink little system that you have going on here. God's just not good enough to be a ruler or king. We want actually a real king. Of course, Samuel was upset by that, but God corrected him and said, no, it's okay. They're rejecting me, not you. So, if all of Israel got together, now what is all of Israel?
All of the leadership.
The leadership. Do you think Samuel's dad was probably there?
Yes.
Do you think... Sorry, Samuel's dad. Saul's dad. Saul's dad, Kish. He was probably there. Why? Because he is, though a small ruler, still a ruler of a tribe or a chunk of Benjamin. It's not that there were only 12 rulers that came to Samuel and said, we need a king, the one from each tribe. No, you have a lot of families from a given tribe. They all have their fathers that must take over and say, hey, God, we need this fixed. There's no difference there. So Kish probably knew about a kingship. So why, when we learn later that Saul's around in the baggage, Saul, the oldest son, if not the only one, would be there at most of these meetings as well, why would Saul not know? He would know. How would he not know? It'd be crazy for him not to know. And guess what he did? Look at his response. This is quite unique. Saul was caught off guard, but he knew what was going on. When Samuel approaches him and states that, was it the verse, my verse here, 20. Okay, Samuel, for the donkeys which you have been lost you for 3 days, do not concern yourself over them, they have been found. Besides, to whom does all the desirable property in Israel belong, if not to you and all your father's family? Saul hears it. What? What are you talking about? But this is Saul's unique response. Saul answers, but I am only a Benjamite and am the smallest of the tribes of Israel. And furthermore, my family is the youngest of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Why then have you spoken to me like this day? That is a very strange response as opposed to any other response he could have chosen. He is giving Samuel the illogical choice. Say, Samuel, you've chosen this makes no sense. You're making a statement that would apply to someone significantly greater than me. And look how small I actually am. He's making a statement that is a kingly statement. All the best properties are kingly. And Saul saying, no, my family is the youngest. We're the smallest. We're the nobodies. Samuel, you're choosing the wrong guy. I think Saul actually knew. And actually, most Judaism considers him knowing because they said, hey, this response is exactly what a humble person would say, which is what Saul was in the early time. In the beginning, he was humble, not so much as he got older. In the beginning, he was humble. He was supposed to be. God chose him. He was a good choice early on. So my argument is Saul did probably know. Maybe not have understood how it was all going to go down, but kind of knew what was going on. Now, whether or not he recognized Samuel, not likely. Because Saul doesn't get to go see him face to face. He's with the baggage normally. Knows him by name, not necessarily by recognition of face. Unless they saw each other, which is no indication they ever did before this point. Though Saul is probably in his 40s, give or take some. Then, of course, Samuel goes through, takes Saul and his attendant, brings him up to the chamber. They get the best portion. This is the portion that is, as Susan points out, reserved for the priest. The priestly portion given to him. Also a symbol there. It happens to be a unique portion of it, which has always struck me as odd as to why Judaism considers the rear end of an animal unkosher, but yet right here, Saul eats it. And so does apparently all the priesthood. Maybe that's why they consider it unkosher. You're not a priest. I'll begin at some other point in time. That's interesting, because I looked, I was like, wait a minute, that seems odd. But anyway, so Saul gets this wonderful portion, the thigh, which is the great part of the animal. He eats it. But all 30 guests see it. This is not in a vacuum. All of these are guests of Samuel. Who are they? Some of them probably are rulers of their families. Not all, but some of them probably are. Some of them are probably friends and acquaintances. Some of them probably know Saul's father. But they saw it. They saw Samuel grab Saul and sit him next to him and give him this wonderful plate of meal. They saw it. They recognized, hey, what's going on here? Because don't get me wrong, all of Israel knew they're waiting for Samuel to choose the king. All of them knew. They're all watching his every move. Is it going to be my son? Is it going to be me? And they see Saul. Saul just became a person of interest. Start getting on his good side. Essentially, that's what's going to happen. Start getting on his good side. Start watching it. Yes, David.
I find it interesting, totally different story, but the number 30 there, there was also in Samson's...
Yes, 30.
30, when she ended up killing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they ended up killing those, but yes, it's a 30 garment issue. But yes, it is nothing more than the men who are witnessing what's happening, and there's quite a few of them.
Because there are two threes in this one chapter.
Yes, there are two threes, and of course, in Messiah's time, there are two threes. Is it 3 days? And I think is it 30 shekels or 40 shekels? I think it was 40.
30.
It was 30. I thought it was 3. Yeah, I thought it was 3. I'll be able to double check that. So yeah, 3 days, 30 shekels. Actually, in Samson's time, I don't recall. It was 7 days and 30 men. But oh well, we'll get there some other point in time. It's a previous point. But the 30 is another symbol. It's pointing out that God's saying, catch your attention. Look. Read what's going on here. I'm doing this on purpose. It's not arbitrary. So he goes to this town, Samuel calls up the rooftop, they talk, we don't know what they said. It would have been great to find out what they said, but it purposefully was not recorded. They obviously talked for some period of time. Some argue what he told them about the Torah, some said no, he told them about what a kingship is, some said no, he's going, who knows. Either way, he talked. They talked about something most likely having to do with prophecies, because he points out to Samuel at the end of the chapter, wait here while I'll tell you what God has said, which is anoints him with king in the next verse in chapter 10. So it would have been nice to know, but they don't have it recorded. So Samuel sends Saul on his way. So Saul is now anointed as ruler over Israel, not king. Some have argued how long he is ruler. Most contend he's pretty much about 2 years unchallenged before David is anointed. After that point, he's on his downward hill as David's on his upward climb. Of course, how old does that make David at this point in time? Pretty close to 20, give or take a year or two, when Saul is anointed king.
Because of Jonathan's age.
Because of Jonathan's age. They're friends. They're both battle-hardy warriors. They both go to the same battles. Jonathan's probably a year or two older. Not much different. But they're the same age. So David's probably around 20. Now, I find this interesting in the timeline. The reason why I try to point out timelines and how old these people are is because events are overlapping. See, previously in Judges and Judges in particular, we had events and then years and years go by before the next event shows up. The people who were involved in the first one aren't around when the second one pops up. Well, at this point in time, that's not the case anymore with kings. People are around. They remember. They know who was there before. They have details of what happened. When the event with the hemorrhoids and whatnot that happened with the Philistines, David was alive. He was probably close to approaching teenage years, 10-ish. Jonathan, also alive. Maybe preteen, or could be a teenager, hard to say. Saul was alive. This has just happened a few years, roughly about 10 to 11 years before this event, is that whole Philistine with them capturing the ark, and they're remembering what that's like. Where the temples that there's now destroyed, now gone, they know what it was like back when the temple existed versus now that it doesn't exist. They remember, which is a big deal why David wanted to rebuild God's house. Because David remembered as a kid going.
Tabernacle.
Yeah. He remembered going. And now it's gone. Now it points out that the Ark of the Covenant lives in, I forgot the guy's name, it's Abijah or whatever it is, his house, for exactly 20 years. And David is the one that brings it out. David's the one who brings it out. As king, he brings it out 20 years later, which this is only 10 years after that event. So it's 10 years from now. David says, okay, Ark, you're coming with me. These guys know each other. They know the events. They remember. They see what God does. This is important. It's important to them. They have the memories. They have the heart that was still there. This is why it's recorded. That's why Samuel wrote it down. To, come on, pay attention. That's our goal. Pay attention. Read what they did. Read why they did it. And it gets you in mind as to what these guys actually were thinking when they do something. Saul knew what happened to the ark back 10 years earlier. David knows it. Jonathan knows it. Samuel knows it. All the leaders know it. They know the temple, the tabernacle's gone now, but they know they're going to build a temple again in a few years from this point. They know the tabernacle's gone. They know God wanders around now. They know they all have their own high places. They know they all no longer make the pilgrimage feasts, festival trips of a year. All those are gone. Which leads to the guidance of how David is raised up. David is such an impressionable age at this point. He sees, he remembers, and his father would have taught him, his brothers would have shown, hey, guess what, when we were kids we used to do X, Y, Z, and you can't do that anymore. That kind of thing. These guys have the heart of God behind them. They may not be great at carrying out all of his word, but they have the heart of God behind them. They know this stuff. Yes,
Ellen. It explains why David says he has this heart to want to rebuild. He's a little kid, and he hears all
And he hears those stories.
And he thinks, wait, this is wrong. Why don't we
do it?
Why doesn't somebody fix that? Why doesn't somebody build another one and bring it and put it back together as a little kid? And
it changes his whole life.
His life
is directed from that point on. Yeah. Of course, he continues that out with Solomon.